You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to New World Pictures Podcast, where we usually talk about every movie released by New World Pictures. And welcome to a new series, Corman Graduates, a brand new series where we're examining the filmography of some of the graduates of Corman's School of Filmmaking. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
Hey, everybody.
And Erica.
Still here. I'm here, everybody.
And we could not have a better guest to start our first episode of Corman's Graduates. He is the author of Jack Hill, the Exploitation and Blaxploitation Master Film by Film. Callum Waddell, thank you so much for joining us for this episode.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm flattered that anybody remembers the fact that I even wrote the book on Jack Hill, but yeah.
It's a great book. I use it constantly whenever we've been talking about movies that Jack Hill has directed that New World put out. But I have to ask, why did you write a book about Jack Hill? What was the inspiration?
Well, first of all, I just want to say I disagree. It's a great book. I think I wrote it when I was kind of still finding my way as a writer, so I dare not open the pages again. I think, I mean, we're going to talk about Track of the Vampire, right? Is that right?
Yep.
Bloodbath, yeah. And I think one of the things that I did really badly in that book is that I'm sorry, I'm going off on a tangent here a little bit, so I'll get back to your question.
Tangent
But I think
away.
one of the things that I did that wasn't so good on that is I never interviewed Stephanie Rothman, and I really regret doing that because I could have. She actually, I had an email contact for her at the time. But why did I decide to do it? I was 25, and I had moved to Los Angeles after my master's degree, and I met Jack Hill, and somebody else was going to be doing a book on him. And it was going to be published by the label Fab Press and here in the UK. And I sat with Jack and he told me this. And I said, oh, you know, I'm really sad about that because I'd like to do a book on you, you know. And, you know, I'd just gone to Los Angeles and I just reached out to people that sort of had an online presence. And Jack was one of them. And at the time I was writing for a couple of film magazines, like cult film magazines. One of them's A Dark Side, which is still ticking along. And I said, you know, can I interview you? Can I meet you? And Jack ended up sort of being a guide in Los Angeles. Like he just kind of would just check in on me, you know, young guy in the city. And he'd offer to like come and pick me up with his wife, Elka, and just show me around or take me out for coffee and stuff like that. And it was great. So I got to know him. And after a couple of years, he finally accepted that the guy that said he was going to write a book about him wasn't going to write a book about him. So it, you know, eventually it pinged back to me and I said, okay, you know, I'll do it. I'd like to do it. I really would. So that's why I just found his story quite interesting because he's one of the Corman graduates that isn't as kind of, I don't want to say revered because in cult circles he is, but isn't, let's say, in terms of the mainstream celebrated in the way that, for instance, Joe Dante is or Jonathan Demme is or Francis Ford Coppola is.
Right.
And, you know, so I kind of wanted to sort of like pull for the underdog and do something on him in the hope that maybe people might look at some of his work, not all of his work, but certainly some of his work and say, you know, there's something pretty special here. And he should be remembered as somebody that came from the Corman School and made cinema that, you know, we're still speaking about in a podcast now. And that still, you know, that has its own place in film history, you know. Obviously, it's a very different direction from, you know, Jonathan Demme, if we became quite a prestige filmmaker and made, you know, Something Wild and Silence of the Lambs, which are films I absolutely love, by the way.
Sure.
You know, Joe Dante, who I don't think has ever made a bad piece of cinema, like ever. I think, you know, Joe Dante's films, you always get entertainment value. He's just really a genius, in my opinion, you know, but was able to navigate that into the mainstream. And that's a tough thing to do. And that makes him really remarkable. And Jack obviously wasn't able to navigate that into the mainstream in the same way. But I don't think that makes his story any less interesting. And that's a story I wanted to tell.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think at the time, that's right around when Quentin Tarantino had re-released Switchblade Sisters, right, via his Rolling Thunder label. And that actually was really when Jack sort of got more name recognition. His name was not really highly, you know, talked about. And certainly when I first saw Switchblade Sisters and sort of was introduced to Jack Hill was around that time, and I think a lot of people. So he never really got to that extra push after he kind of finished working with Corman with Sorceress. And it's a shame. So, you know, He's a fascinating guy for us too, which is why we wanted to start out this series. And I think his movies are worth just exploring and talking about. And that's why we're doing this whole thing. He of course isn't Angelino. He was born in Los Angeles in 1933. His mother, Mildred, was a music teacher, and his father was a set designer who worked on movies for Warner Brothers and then eventually worked for Disney and designed Sleeping Beauty's castle at Disneyland. And not only that, but
That's right.
Tom Sawyer's Island, and he designed most of Main Street. So for people like Mark and I, who grew up in Southern California and went to Disneyland all the time, like his father has an indelible mark on so many people that from this area because he's responsible for stuff that still exists to this day. And then he actually started following his mother's footsteps. He studied music at UCLA, interestingly. And not many people talk about his musical accomplishments. You covered a little bit in your book where he played in the
Dr.
orchestra
Zhivago,
for
right?
Dr. Zhivago. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and not many people know that he was in the orchestra for that. And that's sort of a fascinating little bit. And then he gets and makes The Hole. He makes his student film at UCLA, which is his first collaboration with Sid Haig. And it really gets finished, as you go over in the book, because Quentin Tarantino gives him money to finish it around the time that they're putting out Switchblade Sisters. It's an interesting co collaboration, and of course, mostly interesting too, because the story itself is basically the last act of Apocalypse Now, Francis Ford Coppola's movie, which is interesting. And I love the part in your book where they talked about, or he mentioned that when they were making Apocalypse Now, they were like, "Oh, we're basically making Jack Hill's student film," in that section of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I'm just checking my fact back here. Sorry. Yeah, it's a Golden Bough, isn't it? The book, The Golden Bough, that Kurtz is seen on his table, and there's a link there, which I talk about in the book, to Jack Hill's student film. And he always said that having that book, the acknowledgement that, Jack had read that book and been inspired by that book, and that's how The Host came about. Having that in Apocalypse Now was Francis's little wink to him. And I thought that was pretty cool. I mean, I know that I don't, when you move around in different circles, like, you lose touch with people. That's the way it is, Jack sort of had that, like, when Francis made The Godfather, he obviously, was a superstar and was moving around different circles, so I just didn't see him anymore, but I know that Jack always kind of liked that little nod of the Golden Bough in Apocalypse Now, which is a great film, by the way. I think I don't know. I'm always suspicious when I meet people and they say they don't like the Godfather 1 or 2 or Apocalypse Now. It's kind of like, these are, like, for me, like, just, three of the best pieces of cinema ever. But
Yeah,
yeah,
no.
I like
I don't think many filmmakers had a 70s quite like Coppola, like with the conversation.
I
And
mean, I don't think many people have a decade like Coppola.
it's a pretty unimpeachable stretch of cinema for Coppola. Like, it's pretty hard to do better than that.
Oh my God, absolutely. I mean, I don't think, sorry, Francis, if you're listening to this, I don't think anybody quite then goes from that height to maybe not that height in subsequent decades again, but there are tough
No,
acts to follow, they
he sort
say.
of falls a little bit from that grace, but boy, what a 70s, you know. And I was wondering, do you know if that's how Jack met Roger Corman? One thing that I don't know, the connective thing is he starts working for Roger Corman at that time, but is that because of Coppola? Because Coppola started working for Corman essentially as an assistant to sort of start.
Oh, that's a good question. I can't remember. I know that Francis and Jack were obviously, very good friends in university. And, it's kind of weird because whenever I've read biographies on Coppola, like, Jack Hill was never mentioned. And I always think, it's kind of like bad biography writing. Like, you should kind of know, even if you're not watching so-called quote unquote lowbrow or exploitation films or whatever, you kind of know, like, the parallels and careers of how people kind of emerge. I mean, even, Bogdanovich and, Jack having, oh my goodness, I talk about my book, the link with Bogdanovich as well. But yeah, I, y you know, all of these people sort of have a link in that period in the late 60s who are working for Corman and coming up through Corman. And I know that, obviously, in the case of Jack, it was very much that, that he and Francis were very close. They were kind of, embarking on this filmmaking journey at the same time. They were standout students at UCLU. At UCLU, they were like top of their class, and they were seen as being the two most promising figures to come out of that graduating class. So yeah, I don't know which one kind of led to the other to go to Corman. Again, I've not gone back and looked at my book for a while, but they both worked on the Terror as well, I think. They both had bits and pieces of doing stuff on the Terror. So
I
they were
think,
still kind of, yeah, they were still kind of working together and doing stuff together at that point.
yeah, I think it's maybe because of Francis. My guess would be because Francis starts working for Corman as an assistant, and they actually people told us that people that we've interviewed that worked for Corman and New World at that time have told us that they lived very close together, Roger Corman and Coppola. In fact, they were like next door neighbors, and Corman would go over and shave and stuff in his place back when they were single gentlemen. Or maybe I guess when Corman was single, but in any case, and of course,
Corman was so. Wait, are you trying to tell me that Corman was so cheap he wouldn't buy his own razor?
I mean, if Coppola has one, and
I
he
would
seems
hope
to
he
always
has a
have a
few.
beard, so it's like he's not using it, so why not? And it's
Yeah,
and
just to quickly intervene. Sorry, I'm going to correct myself. I'm right. Yeah. So Peter Bogdanovich, he cast Ellen Burstyn in The Last Picture Show after seeing Pit Stop, Jack Hill's film. And I know that was one of the things. I mean, Bogdanovich has passed away, and obviously isn't here to defend it. But I know it was one of the things that really irked Jack. I think Jack always, when I was interviewing him for the book, because there were a lot of interviews with him, I know he felt a little bit like underappreciated. Like I say, when biographers write books about Peter Bogdanovich, who again, pretty incredible Sidonese, and Francis Ford Coppola, Jack's at least part in these, however even small, was not really mentioned. And yeah, Peter Bogdanovich kind of cast, well, Jack always told me his side of it was that Bogdanovich saw, Pit Stop, and he was working with Corman at the time. And when he made The Last Picture Show, he was like, I want this actress to be in The Last Picture Show, and it was Ellen Burstyn. And then Ellen Burstyn obviously becomes this huge actress, and people still talk about Ellen Burstyn as, all her big kind of breakout was The Last Picture Show. Well, sure it was, but she was also a central part of Pit Stop.
Big part is that she's got a huge role in that, and
Yeah,
we're not at Pit Stop yet, but man, what a great film and
that
highly
is a great film.
underappreciated. Perhaps my favorite. I'll just tip it of Jack Hill's movies is Pit Stop. It's an excellent movie, especially how it rises above the exploitation elements and how he's able
Very
to do
much,
that. But eventually, Jack does work for Corman, however that comes about, and he works on the TV version of the Wasp Woman, which is a movie we talked about for our Corman birthday episode, but not for the regular movie. He does like a 10-minute intro and like another scene just for the TV rights, so that Corman can sell the movie to TV and make it a little bit longer than the hour running time. He also works on Dementia 13, so being excluded from Coppola is also a tragedy in that, because he does shoot a few scenes for Dementia 13, and then they both work on The Terror. Coppola brought some of the outside scenes, because he shot a lot of them up in the Bay Area, out on the beach there. And then I think Jack Hill sort of does lots of little bits and pieces and sort of does some editing on it. And then, but so many people worked on The Terror, it's hard to tell who did what. But and then Roger gives Jack really his first shot at making a movie, though not maybe what Jack considers his directorial debut, but he gets to make Bloodbath, aka Track the Vampire.
He's an artist, blessed with talent, cursed with a vampire's lust.
Which, at the time you wrote the book, Arrow put out this Blu-ray afterwards, which had the very many different versions of the movie. And I think it's out of print, this Blu-ray, so I don't have it. But my question is, have you ever seen the actual version of Bloodbath? I mean, does that even exist?
I can't answer that because it's been so long. I mean, when you were doing this, and it was going to be Mondo Keyhole and
Initially,
Spider Baby,
yes.
I was a bit more, I can answer this. I went through different minimal different season versions when I was writing my book, if I recall. Some of these were what Jack sent me, and some of these were just like pirate discs, like honestly. So I don't know if I ever saw the Bloodbath, Bloodbath or whoever. The versions that I remember seeing were called Track of the Vampire, I think, to be honest. I know that Jack would always kind of argue his side of this and always kind of make out that Stephanie Rothman tried to destroy his vision and stuff. And obviously, being, again, this is a problem with my book, right? Being kind of like close with Jack and having him as a friend, I didn't want to dispute what he said.
Right.
So I kind of didn't give Stephanie her say and I didn't get involved in it. And since then, I've sort of become more sympathetic, I think, to Stephanie's role as a woman in the film industry at that time, trying to break through, trying to make a name for herself. And, always kind of seemingly having her vision compromised, I think, when she was, trying to do something for herself. Even a film like Terminal Island, which I'm quite fond of and which I think is a pretty decent film, and I'm glad that Vinegar Syndrome did a really fantastic edition of it and, brought it back. And it's like you say, it's a shame so many of these discs go out of print, right? But Terminal Island, if anybody listening to this hasn't seen it, it's a pretty interesting sort of feminist version of what the big birdcage or the big dollhouse might look like with a woman in
For
charge,
sure.
right? And it's got Tom Selleck in it, and it is a pretty cool little movie. And it's not great by any minor means, but you kind of watch it and go, I see what she was trying to do here and why she had to put in these exploitable elements but was trying to subvert them, or the student nurses, which begins with sex and then doesn't have sex for a long time because she's got it out of the way. And there's an academic I want to give a shout out to called Alicia Kosmaff, who's written a book called The Films of Stephanie Rothman. And it's a really good read, and she quite rightly criticizes my view of Track of the Vampire in her book, and then gives me a bit of a shout out for saying that I agreed with her because she got in touch with me and I apologized, because Stephanie does deserve a place in that book, and I know that Jack and her had another falling out over Big Dollhouse. I think her husband was meant to be involved in the writing of that, but I think Jack Hill was somebody who at the time was working in an industry which was very patriarchal, where I think what the male figures wanted kind of went, and perhaps ran into this young female upstart. Because if we look at the 60s, there's not many female filmmakers who are kind of coming through at all. I mean, in the exploitation circles, who have you got? You've got Roberta Findlay, maybe, Doris Wishman, I could see a sort of clash there, like, this is my film, no, this is my film. I don't want to take the side of anyone. I just wanted to point out a falling and that I think Stephanie deserves her voice in this. So I didn't want the conversation to be damning of her or negative towards her, because I don't know who the auteur of Track of the Vampire is or Bloodbath. I only know that Jack wasn't happy with it. And if you read Alicia Kosma's book, Stephanie wasn't happy with it. So I think for Jack, like Spider Baby, he always said to me, was his first proper film, and Track of the Vampire was a very unhappy experience, and it seems to have been that way for Stephanie Rothman as well. But at the time, I also think we've got to remember that Corman was kind of just settling into trying to be an entrepreneur, and kind of really working out what worked and what didn't, because he made that great film with William Shatner about racism in the Mid-South, which
The
completely
Intruder.
failed. And he said, I'm never going to do like a personal film again like this, instead I'm going to
Because he and his brother funded it, and they took, and it was a huge loss. Nobody wanted to see it, and it didn't do well.
exactly yeah
Yeah, and at a
yeah
point they
it's
were doing the film group, and they were starting to try to move. I think Corman had designs of moving away from AIP and trying to actually make his own name, and so they were producing more films on their own, he and Gene. And partly that's what is the problem with Bloodbath, is that he sets Jack up to, for one, do one of the most Corman assignments of all. So talk about a Corman graduate when you're given a movie that Corman is invested in, that shot in Yugoslavia, called Operation Titian, where that Coppola is supposed to supervise, and it's supposed to be a horror film. Comes back, it's a thriller. Jack said Coppola was distracted by his girlfriend and eventual wife, Eleanor. And so the movie comes back unusable for Corman. So Jack is hired to fix it and make a film about it. So he decides to make it an artist driven to kill young women and dip them in wax, kind of a mix of Corman's A Bucket of Blood and Wax Museum kind of thing. And I think it's I mean, you're talking about the Stephanie Rothman part. I think it's kind of a beautiful disaster of a movie for me. I mean, having watched it, because Jack is trying to like make this artist movie, this sort of serious thriller, but also with some scenes that were in Yugoslavia, having I think they only shared in that shot this the lead actor, William Campbell, who was in the Operation Titian, I guess, again, that Corman then released later as Portrait of Terror. So he got so many movies out of this. It's crazy. And but he gets it and he makes his version, and then Corman is away in Yugoslavia and he's shooting the Secret Invasion, I believe. So he is not able to like see any of it. And so that's when Hill went off to make Spider Baby. And then when Corman comes back, he doesn't like the mix, I guess, of the Yugoslavian footage and what Jack Hill has shot. So he gives it to Stephanie Rothman. Stephanie Rothman's like, okay, I have to do exploitation, I guess. So I'll just add vampires, which seems to be her go-to because she also did the Velvet Vampire
Velvet Vampire, yeah.
for New World Pictures, and which is a great movie. And
It's a really cool film, yeah.
yeah, less to do with vampires than it has to do with dune buggies, but at the same time, no, I mean, it's such a good movie, and it has the vampire part of it is just a thing she had to do. So she's just trying to do her thing. Jack Hill's trying to do his thing. They're just trying to make something out of this weird movie.
But she had the unfortunate circumstance of Robert Campbell not wanting to come back for a third round of reshoots.
William, yes, he did
Or
not.
William,
Yeah,
sorry.
he did not want to. He shot with Jack, had already shot the movie in Yugoslavia. So by the time it gets to Stephanie, he's like, I'm no thank you. But also, he had commanded a huge, from your book, he commanded a lot of money, which Corman wasn't happy about, to come back and reshoot with Jack. So I don't know if he probably figured, I'm not going to get paid. Roger is not going to pay me again. But there's this beautiful scene that I think is really representative of the whole thing. It's a sequence where Sortie, William Campbell, he tells his model about one of his ancestors, and he's in his apartment, and he tells about his ancestors also this great artist who was also driven mad, and you see a woman in his canvas.
You know, Sordi's paintings apparently had a sort of magical power to affect the viewer. Modern psychologists would say that he depicted the contents of the unconscious mind. Church expressed it much the same way by saying he was in league with the devil. But only Satan could inspire it.
And you see her in there sort of laughing. And then we switch to this desert scene with a woman dancing around in the wind. And he's there too, sort of alone, as the camera tracks back and shows him sort of on his own. And a studio sort of in this desert. And then it comes back to the studio, and suddenly he becomes a vampire. And yet he kills the model with a butcher knife and then dumps her in wax. And you're like, this, look, it's a lot. But you're not going to get this in many films. You know what I mean? So good. You know, whatever your thoughts are, I'm like, you know what? This is kind of an interesting movie, you know?
I mean, I always saw a lot of these Corman-produced films from the 70s, like even Pit Stop, which I love, and you know, which is you know far better film than Track of the Vampire, and certainly The Terror. But I always saw these Corman films from the 60s, where he's sort of striking out alone as a producer, but at least before he makes his kind of you know trippy films, his LSD films, which are
Right.
you know really stylish, and some of his biker films, you know. I always saw it as him just, you know, kind of feeling the market and trying to find his way. And I know that Jack was very disparaging in the book of Roger Corman, which I think he felt pretty bad about. Well, I know he did because I said to him, oh, hey, guess who I just did an interview with in Edinburgh? And he was like, who? I said, oh, Roger Corman. I gave him a copy of your book of my book. And he was like, oh my goodness, I would never have said these things if I knew he was ever going to read them. So
Oh no.
yeah, just a little aside there. But you know, I think Roger was always supportive of Jack Hill because there's an academic I know who teaches now in Birmingham called Xavier Mendick. And Xavier did a book which was introduced by Roger Corman. It might even be called A Cult Movie Reader, or maybe it's one of his others. And Roger Corman introduces it and says, you know, this book's really essential because we all, you know, now, you know, universities and academia, you know, my world has opened up to learn about these directors that academics once didn't really talk about. And I can't remember which ones he used, but I suppose nowadays, for instance, it's not unusual to go to university and learn about the films of Joe Dante or Wes Craven, or Larry Cohen or whatever. And he sort of said, but what about the directors that we know less about, that there's not a lot of writing about? And he used Jack Hill as an example. And I don't think Roger Corman would have done that if he didn't see Jack Hill as having that value, as having, to single him out of all the directors he worked with who didn't go on to, sort of conquer the mainstream the way that Dante or Demme or Francis Ford Coppola did, I think shows that respect. I'm getting a little bit off the track of the vampire thing now. But I think anybody who goes back and watches Track of the Vampire or Bloodbath, I think, for me, in the way that I wrote about it, I was kind of seeing it in that context of just Roger Corman finding his feet, and finding his feet with a little kind of, group of directors that he trusted. And, for better or for worse, Jack Hill, Stephanie Rothman, Francis Ford Coppola were part of that initial go-to group that he had faith in to make a product that he wanted, and I think that speaks really well for all three of them. Not that Francis needs my blessing, but
You never
for
know.
Stephanie and Jack, I think it speaks pretty highly for them, but I don't know, that bitterness seemed to linger, that was a bad project. When I wrote the book and I interviewed Jack, like I don't think anything was mended with Stephanie, and he felt Stephanie had kind of like made a mockery out of what he had filmed. And like I say, for Alicia Cosma, when she does the films of Stephanie Rothman, which is a recent book, she doesn't seem very happy with the finished film either. So it's a bit of a shame that there wasn't just one director making this weird film out in Yugoslavia. I can't even imagine what we'd been like filming out in Yugoslavia out there back then. Never mind filming an exploitation film out there.
And I think now that the Arrow Blu-ray has parsed this out into separate sections, that like the one we watch is still called Bloodbath. It's about a little over an hour longer. I think the Track of the Vampire is another one you can also see it. It's like an hour 15, and that's when they also padded it again with more footage of Stephanie's version of the movie to try to like again sell it on TV. And then you actually can watch Portrait of Terror, and you can probably watch the original Operation Titian, which is crazy that there's so many versions of this one movie. I in your book you say, while it's impossible to recommend Track of the Vampire as anything other than a fan-only curio, it is certainly weird enough to warrant its place in Hill's oeuvre, which I totally agree with.
Thanks.
I think it's such an interesting movie despite like its many masters, right? Which I think ultimately says a lot more about Corman than it does about Hill and Rothman, but both of them share like the fact that they were not able to get beyond exploitation, and both of them had designs to do so, but neither of them were able to truly get past that. And so it does kind of put a stain on their reputations to some degree, and I'm sure they felt that as younger filmmakers. But I think for Hill, like leaning into this thriller aspect, but he also adds that comic aspects of the beatniks and his satire of modern art, which again, I think calls a lot to Corman's Bucket of Blood, but I still think that's a recurring theme for his movies. And
It's where it belongs to that little. I mean, I don't know if there was a cycle of films doing this, but it also kind of reminded me weirdly of like Color Me Blood Red by Herschel Gordon Lewis. This whole period of like filmmakers sort of looking at themselves by using demented artists of some sort. It's kind of weird that there seemed to be like some sort of lightning bulb going off in the heads of exploitation filmmakers.
And you mentioned that in the book too, that this is sort of like after that after Herschel Gordon Lewis sort of made his sort of seminal film, that everybody was sort of influenced by that a little bit. And I'm not sure if how much that influenced Jack on this particular movie, because it's such an odd assignment, but it had to be in the air.
I always felt that Spider Baby sort of is its own thing, of course, but it's still belong, and I get it belongs to the Addams family, right? And I get, and you have the monsters and stuff like that. But I still always thought that Spider Baby belonged in the same sort of universe as, 2000 Maniacs, even if Jack had seen it or not. And I sort of feel the same about, Bloodbath, Track of the Vampire. It sort of belongs in that universe, because all of these exploitation directors, they are trying to do something that's ultimately going to get an audience at the time. And this is the other thing we really need to separate ourselves from now, which I had to do even writing the book. You know, back then we can understand why Jack and Stephanie sort of thought, oh my God, like this is my career for goodness sake. Because, you know, the belief back then obviously wasn't there was even going to be this thing called videotape, never mind this thing called 4K Blu-ray where you could get all of these editions on a disc. It was like nobody's ever going to see this thing, and when they do see it, it's going to be credited to me, or it's going to be, you know, in Stephanie Rothman's case, it's a Stephanie Rothman film, you know, and I don't want this piece of crap with my name on it going out there. Like what am I going to do, you know? Because I might never get another job again. I mean, that's all anybody's going to know of me, that I made this critically reviled piece of crap. And, you know, at least in the case of Herschel Gordon Lewis, he never really aspired to be a highbrow filmmaker. He was a marketing guy who made, you know, cheap, sleazy cinema for a quick buck, right? And was very good at it. But in the case of Jack and Stephanie, of course, they were aspiring to the sort of career that eventually Francis Ford Coppola had. You know, I would want to be a, you know, a quote unquote proper filmmaker who's spoken about as an artist, you know. At least that's what I felt Jack wanted, from speaking to him, and you know, from reading Alicia's book. I mean, it seems that's what Stephanie's hope and goal was. Understandably as well. I mean, that's what, you know, most filmmakers want. Most filmmakers don't want to be, you know, Herschel Gordon Lewis, right? I think maybe the guy that makes the Terrifier films does. Although budget, you know, in terms of the money he's getting in, I think, you know, he's pretty happy he's not. But yeah, so I think that's it, isn't it? I can imagine, I can see their disappointment with this. I haven't seen it. I've not seen it in a long time. But I remember thinking, I can, you know, you can see it's a mishmash. And I remember thinking when I saw it, and I saw the different versions. I saw at least two different versions. I remember thinking, oh, this is bad. I should also mention, just because it's come in my head, Tim Lucas did a wonderful two-part on this film in Video Watchdog, and I think it was in early issues of Video Watchdog. But I dare say, in fact, I don't dare say, he did a better job of breaking it down than I did. So I recommend anybody, you know, listening to this who kind of wants that. And I know that Tim's on the Blu-ray, but anybody who wants to, you know, learn about this should really read Tim's writing on it, because it's really good.
There's on the Arrow Blu-ray there, he's there and does like a video, I think of probably a video essay that sort of breaks down the different versions of the movie.
Oh yeah, quite rightly. He's the go-to this film.
But also, of course, because Bloodbath is starts with Jack Hill, it has Sid Haig in it, and it's an interesting Sid Haig performance. I'm curious what your guys' thoughts are, because I think, to me, it was a mixed bag, because I think when he's in the cafe and he's shooting with Jack, he's very happy. He does eventually shoot with Stephanie Rothman, but his performance to me sort of says, like, I don't know, I'm not really into this. Because he has a scene where he goes, where they're like chasing, and he says,
"What's he got to do with this? I thought we were chasing that vampire."
Exactly.
It feels like he's very much phoning it in, which is unusual for Haig, because at the very least, despite what you might think of some of the movies he appeared in, he's certainly committed. That was something that he would do. And so it's interesting that he has this sort of up and down performance in this.
It's funny that you call that out because I specifically, that really stuck out to me when he said that. Because, first of all, at the beginning of the movie, he's obviously a beatnik and they're just too a hyper level into art, right? It's definitely a parody of being just so wowed by all this modern art
Course.
to just an over the top degree. And then to just say, "Hey, I thought we were supposed to be chasing a vampire," which should automatically bring out some more emotion that you're chasing a vampire. I thought, wow, he was able to say that so nonplussed. Like, well, I guess we're chasing. Wait, I thought we were chasing a vampire. Like, it was a fascinating approach to saying a line that should have much more impact.
Yeah, they've accepted their fate of going from art appreciators to vampire chasers. They've really, the journey, you know, it's taken a swing
Besides the
here.
fact that his beard has grown exponentially in the short amount of time from the opening cafe scenes to when they're chasing a vampire. Maybe chasing a vampire makes your hair grow, so I should chase a vampire.
Who knew?
It's
No.
the cold, it's the cold night air. It sort of brings out the
Right.
follicles just
That
react and
cold
expand.
Venice, Los Angeles air.
It's an interesting, it's an interesting performance. I think the really good performance too is William Campbell. And at the ending of the movie, which Jack says in your book is really, he says it's 80% his movie, but that Stephanie gets the ending. And yet the end of the movie is basically all the wax figures coming back to life to kill Campbell. And that interior is again all done in Glendale, California, at a studio, which he then uses for a spider baby. But it's interesting that he says that it's Rothman's because it feels like that's definitely his ending, at least. So I don't know if he has that right. I mean, I'd have to believe him. He made the movie, but it just seems like, how does this not his ending?
I think maybe look at Alicia's book. I'd need to go back and read the chapter on
Yeah, I do have her book. It's with not within reach here, but I do have it, and
Yeah, I'm the same.
I
It's like through my lounge. But yeah, I think she, like I say, she's her book on Stephanie is very, like I say, very good. And I got the impression from reading her book that, Stephanie had more involvement in this than perhaps Jack's admitting to. And that's how we get this kind of mishmash of a film. But yeah, obviously, like I say, it's a film that it's been so long since I've seen it. And yeah, so I can't comment on the ending of it,
Yeah,
unfortunately.
that's
I
fine.
think that and Mondo Keyhole were the films of Jack's that I probably find the least interesting, to be honest.
That's fair. That's fair. And we will be getting to Mondo
I
Keyhole
call it the
next
films of
week.
Jack's. It might be the film with Stephanie, right? In that case, it's still the film with Stephanie Rothman's I find least interesting as well.
And it seems like they agree with you.
But if you were to watch Bloodbath, the version Bloodbath, and you didn't know the backstory, like I have to say they do a pretty incredible job of mixing Yugoslavia with Venice Beach and not making it look like so drastically different that you're saying, I mean, besides the fact that there's a bunch of beach scenes, but certainly the cityscape, the chase scene, it feels like, I don't know if that's in Yugoslavia. I don't know if that's in Venice Beach. And that's great because you fooled me. And I don't know if I didn't know that this was three movies spliced together into one, that I would. I mean, maybe the vampire stuff, I'd say, well, that's a wild swing. Where did that come from? Especially changing the person's face and it being an entirely different
To
actor.
somebody they don't even know. We don't even know who did it. It's
Right.
nobody even knows who that person is.
But I have to think. Looking at some of the movies that were made at that time, too, I wouldn't necessarily immediately leap to, well, they must have spliced together three different movies. Like they do a pretty good job of making it all come together in as cohesive of a manner as possible that it sort of makes sense. I mean, not really, but enough that you could watch it and say, okay, well, that's an interesting movie, and it took some wild swings.
There's a very interesting death in a pool, and as you point out, Callum, very rightly, this happens a lot. The deaths, the vampire deaths, happen in full view of many other people, including the one on the merry-go-round where they're clearly there's people right there. There's people if you see right behind them, it's not there in the distance. They're literally right behind them, and yet he's trying to murder her, and everybody casually gets off the merry-go-round like, well, that
But to be fair, if it's LA, no one's gonna care. They're gonna
was
just let that go. That's gonna
That's
be like,
shot in
oh,
LA. That's definitely shot in LA.
let's just
When
get ahead of
she's
the police traffic. Let's leave. Let's leave now. No one's gonna
Yo, let's
care.
get to the car. It's gonna be a mess to get out of here.
In fact, she screams at one of the riders on the merry-go-round, "Help me, this guy's chasing me." And the guy flat out says, "Nah, I'm not helping you."
Very LA. That's very LA. That's where it's difficult to mix it in with Yugoslavia because Yugoslavia might have had a different reaction. LA, no, that's still to this day. Being like, that seems like your business. I gotta I got somewhere. I got to go to a cafe by 4, so I really need to get out of here. So.
And I know it's only 2, but you know,
Yeah,
traffic.
but it's gonna. Oh man, yeah, it's.
Traffic.
I gotta go across town. Are you kidding? In this city? So any final thoughts on Bloodbath before we move on to Spider Baby, guys? I know for us, I really dug it. I actually really liked it. I was surprised how much I liked it.
I'm going to admit from memory, I just found it a bit of a slog. Sorry.
No, I totally understand.
I remember thinking like, I agree with what Mark said. Like, I think that, you know, it is, again, I'm going by my memory. It is kind of interesting how it feels at least coherent. But I remember going through it and like having to watch it, you know, a few times for the book and thinking, I'm not really gelling with it. It doesn't really work for me. I don't think it's as bad as a terror. There you go.
There you go.
But again,
Fair.
one of the terrors, Jack Nicholson said this. He said basically there's not movies like The Terror. And I will agree that like while The Terror is a mess and there's just no doubt about it doesn't have any story that you can really latch on to. It is an absolute mess. But there's just you no one makes movies like that. Nobody makes movies where they're going to take a star and shoot him for 2 days and then later figure out a story around him that gets passed off to Monty Hellman and Jack Hill and Coppola and all these different people to just try to make sense of something. Even Corman himself and then Jack Nicholson shoots a day because he says, "Hey, everyone else has shot on this thing. Can I direct the last day?" You know, it's just such a crazy disaster. And that's kind of what this is. It's definitely an interesting start of Jack Hill's career, but I'm sure for him, far more frustrating. But for us, I don't know. I enjoyed it. I don't, I can understand.
I think Bloodbath evokes a certain like, ooh, this is going to be messy and this is going to be violent. It's more of like a blood occasional sprinkle,
I mean, that's pure Corman, isn't it?
Yeah, and more like a wax bath in this one, if anything else. But he does kill the butcher knife's kill certainly
Yeah,
has some gore to
that's
it.
pretty brutal, yeah.
But that's probably the most. So while he has made Bloodbath and Corman is in Yugoslavia, he basically takes off to make Spider Baby.
Sit round a fire with this cup of brew, a fiend and a werewolf on each side of you. This cannibal orgy is strange to behold and the maddest story ever told.
They are all like this, like a little
He goes off to make his first movie, and it's really because of, again, one of the actors that is actually in Bloodbath that he's able to kind of make this movie. So Carl Schanzer was working as
Yes, that's
a
right.
private investigator, and that is how we get the money to make Spider Baby. And what's interesting is that they really let Jack kind of do whatever he wants. They are really more interested in funding the movie than they are in what the content is. And while they do eventually have to bring in people to pay for the rest of the movie to kind of get it to finish, they weren't handing out notes about what the movie was going to be about. And as you said, we sort of have this weird monster family that sort of ends up being the result of this. It's a very wild, wild movie if people haven't seen it. And a comedy, which is not something that Jack Hill made very often.
I think two things. I think Jack's career has a certain, you know, weird prophecy to it, in the sense that, you know, we begin with Track of the Vampire, Bloodbath, and Jack has, you know, when he sees the finished version, which, you know, after Stephanie Roslin comes on board, he's obviously mortified and unhappy, and she's unhappy, so both are unhappy with this job that Corman's given them. And yet I always found it quite interesting that, you know, and I maybe should have said this in my book, that Jack doesn't really kind of learn from that. So he goes on to make 4 films after Spider Baby. He goes on to make 4 films in Mexico that are finished by somebody else. He goes on to do Aya Grippi in I think Sweden, right, with Jess Franco's producer, and it's finished by someone else, right? And then, you know, he comes back and works with Corman. And, you know, while he has a good experience to some extent with the big dollhouse and the big birdcage, you know, then has a horrible experience with Sorcerer. And it is one of these, sorry, Sorceress, and it is kind of one of these things where you sort of go, well, you know, the warning signs are there that maybe this this setup's not really working for you. So yeah, I just wanted to say that, which because I just find it quite interesting that you keep coming back to the well and hoping for a different result. But yeah, in the case of Spider Baby, I think there's so much that's interesting. I think Manton Moreland at the beginning is a really interesting cameo. I think that the film, although it's operating, like I say, in the same sort of, I think, universe as something like 2000 Maniacs, which Herschel Gordon Lewis made, and which I'm almost completely sure Jack Hill never saw. I think it's, but it's working in exactly the same sort of idea of, the sort of great unwashed that are out there and that you're hidden from when you're in the city. And as soon as you go out to the big open space, urban, you run into these people, and these people are, particularly slimy and unwashed, quite literally, and dangerous. And it's, unconscious or not, I suppose it's a very American story, because as we even see today, it's, politically, since the Civil War, still and before, it's still a very divided country. And I think that's how you get that sort of cycle of films which Spider Baby seems to anticipate. And I mean films like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and, The Hills Have Eyes and Just Before Dawn. And I know that all of these films also have a different, also have different sources. Texas Chainsaw Massacre obviously is going to, look at Wisconsin and Ed Gein, and Hills Have Eyes is taking its cue from Sonny Bean in Scotland. And Just Before Dawn's kind of different from these as well. But they're all doing the same sort of thing, and maybe even saying the same sort of thing. A film like Motel Hell as well, they're kind of working within that same area. And I think that's what Spider Baby's doing. And then again, that aspect of prophecy, Sid Haig being in Spider Baby eventually becomes a similar great unwashed, be careful of the urban and the wide roads and the rural America. When you leave urban America, you get into this rural area, and goodness knows who's out there, and they have guns and they're dangerous and they're scary. And you sort of have that when Sid Haig eventually hooks up with Rob Zombie. And having I mean, I got to know Sid Haig quite well. I mean, he used to send me a birthday card every year, which was lovely, and it's much missed, because God rest his soul, is no longer with us. And I've interviewed Rob Zombie several times, and Rob obviously talks about Spider Baby's influence, and that Spider Baby was a direct influence on House of a Thousand Corpses. And I'm not a fan of the film. I don't particularly like the film, but that influence of Spider Baby's there. It's just a much nastier version, a much more, unforgiving version, where Spider Baby was obviously very jokey, very funny. And I just another little aside, I actually got to introduce Jack Hill to Toby Hooper, because I brought them both to San Francisco for a film festival, and I hosted Toby on stage, and we showed Toolbox Murders, and I did this Q&A with Toby, which you can see on the Arrow version of the Funhouse, I think. But Jack Hill was there. Jack Hill was the person that did the next day, so I got to go out and get very drunk with Toby Hooper, which was great. And also have, Jack doesn't drink alcohol, so Jack was sober. But Jack and Toby sort of spoke about Spider Baby, and Toby hadn't seen it when he did Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But like I say, you can still see that they're coming up with the same ideas, the same universe, the same idea of, when you're a city slicker, which is Texas Chainsaw Massacre, right? I mean, when you're like an Austin kid like Toby Hooper, hey, what's out there in the rest of Texas when you go into that, that great, when you leave the urban and you go into that great rural space, like what is there? What do you have to fear? As a foreigner, they very much feel like foreign films to me. They're about a world that I've not really explored. I mean, when I lived in California, I took a couple of drives. I don't drive, but a friend of mine drove me from Los Angeles to Las Vegas once, and another case, we drove right out to somebody's place, and we had to stop in this old gas station. There was a liquor store next to it and a bar, and the bar was scary, man. I mean, I'm not lying. It was very different from Los Angeles Central, So I sort of see that, and I don't live amongst it, Our kind of dangerous areas are sort of like a block away from the city, or a block away from where I'm living right now, It's like,
I think that's very perceptive of you, and I totally agree. I mean, that's why I think Texas Chainsaw has the reputation it has, because there is something about that open rural space that, for me, growing up in the city, has always petrified me. When we visit Erica, grew up in a very rural part of Indiana, and whenever we go out there, I'm always like, there is just something. We got a lot of woods here. What's going on there? What's going on in there? That there's something out there. We don't know. And most people find it very peaceful. I find it very terrifying. So I totally,
Deliverance, right?
yeah, totally. And that's funny that Toby hadn't seen this movie because it absolutely made Spider Baby made me think like, that had to be seen by Tobe Hooper because it seems like such a precursor to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But you're right that it's a movie of prophecy. I think it's very well said because it feels like a parody of this kind of movie, which we're not familiar with yet. That's the thing that Spider Baby is. It's like we don't have these movies filled with murderers that are happily getting together, getting along as family. We eventually get those movies, but we don't have them yet. So to make a big comedy, which he makes this silly opening credit sequence, is animated to be like, this is gonna be funny. And then hires Mantan Moreland to be the opening scene, who has known for comedic roles throughout his career, and then kills him off to be like, it's funny, but also it's kind of dangerous. But yet we're not familiar with this movie kind of movie yet. And it does feel like Jack's well ahead of himself. And I do have to say, I love the photography in this. This is the Alfred Taylor part of Jack's career. He works with Alfred Taylor for his sections of Bloodbath, and Alfred Taylor also shoots all the footage of this, and it professed on the Blu-ray how much he loves working in black and white. That's his. He goes on to shoot other. He returns to Jack to shoot Swinging Cheerleaders, and he does shoot Killer Clowns from Outer Space, of all things. But he preferred black and white, and it gives it that universal monster feel, which I think Jack is trying to go for in both of these movies, to be honest. But he sort of really gets it in those, and just some of the way that things are lit, the staircase when the sisters come down and they're in the shadow, and then he puts the flashlight on them. There's just some of those things that are just incredibly gorgeous cinematography for a movie that's supposed to be a laugh.
It's a great looking film. It's really, the performances are top notch. Lon Chaney Jr., who's such a great actor. I love him in this film. I love the postmodern element where he acknowledges Wolfman, and references his character in the Wolfman, right?
There's going to be a full moon tonight.
Again, really ahead of the curve. I mean, you weren't really seeing horror films at that time referencing the universe of other horror films, let alone an actor reference his most famous character in a film, like he becomes Larry Talbot for 5 seconds. And I think that, it's well ahead of the curve in that. There's just so much to love about Spider Baby. For me, it's a brilliant piece of cinema. And I think that if somebody made that same film, even today, obviously shooting on film and not digital or whatever, right? But I mean, if somebody made that film today, that would be a film festival phenomenon, I think. It just, I think audiences aren't ready, distributors aren't ready for it. I don't know if audiences are not, but distributors aren't ready for it. Don't know what to do with it. It sinks, until Tarantino. I don't know if you, I think I wrote about in my book, but the reason that Spider Baby is with us is because Jack Hill found a 35mm print and had to break into the lab and steal it and get it out,
That's incredible. That's
and
incredible.
yeah, with and Tarantino was talking about it and telling people that Spider Baby is a great movie, and I think that it is such a good film. It is a film that holds up. It's a film that's ahead of its time. In many ways, it's kind of Jack's most, maybe his most important, maybe not his most important film, maybe at least on a level with the two Pam Grier films, because of course, they're sort of like anticipating things like Alien, at least in terms of like the strong central female character who, it takes matters into her own hands. And of course, they launch Pam Grier, who's such an important figure in pop culture, in cinema. Full stop. I mean, one of the most important figures I think that's ever been in front of a film camera. So
And
I
you're
think
talking about specifically the Coffee Foxy Brown
Coffee and Foxy
films,
Brown, rather than the Big Dollhouse and the Big Birdcage. I mean, she steals the show in these films, but Coffee and Foxy Brown are really when you see Pam Grier become, I think, Pam Grier, and you'd have to be a real idiot, I think, to watch these films and not see this is a performance that is dominating every second of screen time. Like,
Yeah.
she's
In
just
the women in
really
prison
amazing.
movies, she's a star in Wait. And then in
Yeah,
Coffee and Foxy
right.
Brown, she's clearly a star. She's clearly a
Oh yeah,
huge
she's a
star.
star. Like she's a star. I mean, and the fact that she goes on to sort of become the most successful African American, actress ever at that point. And I think still probably the most important and influential African American actress. Even, to recent work like the L Word, which I think is so important. Yeah, she's great, So maybe they're his most important films in terms of the influence they've had, in terms of the longevity they've had, Foxy Brown becoming a rapper, et cetera, but I think Spider Baby's still, so in terms of what he's doing within horror might be his is surely, almost as important or as important, because like I say, it's anticipating the movement of the genre. It's understanding that postmodernism might become a thing, and it does. And it's a clever postmodernism. It's funny. It's not like a kind of crappy homage or just somebody repeating dialogue for whatever reason. This is feeding into the film narrative. And I think that I and like I say, it really does give us that rural American horror. It's taking from, like I say, it's operating in the same universe that Herschel Gordon Lewis has done with 2000 Maniacs, and it's clearly taken from Psycho. Alfred Hitchcock's, the guy that gets there before everyone, right? But like you said, the whole murderous family in a house, that the family that slays together stays together, that sort of thing. I mean, all respect to him. I mean, it's before the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which may well be the most important horror film ever made, and Jack's there right before it.
Yeah, and in the commentary on the Arrow Blu-ray for Spider Baby, Jack and Sid Haig talk about Texas Chainsaw Massacre and how much people say, "Oh, that's an influence," and they had to say, "No, Texas Chainsaw follows like 10 years later. This is the," and so they get thrown together. So it's so interesting that you were able to sort of bring the two of those guys, the filmmakers, together. And I think there's something about it being on Blu-ray and being on the physical media is so important that it keeps these films going and alive. But there's something that gets somewhat lost in that Spider Baby is this true cult film because it takes years to even make it to be released. And then once it's released, it's kind of dumped. It doesn't get anywhere. It takes a long time. So Lon Chaney never really got to see how well it was embraced. So he kind of misses out, which is a shame because as you said, his performance in this is fantastic. That monologue.
Oh, it's so good.
Children, I've got something I want to tell you, and I want you to listen very, very carefully. A long, long time ago, I promised your daddy that I'd take care of you and Ralph forever and ever. And then came this Mr. Schlocker. He was a nasty, mean man. He wanted to take you away where old Bruno would never see you again. You hurt Mr. Schlocker, and he can't do that now.
He's so good, and he almost wasn't in the movie. They only had $2,500 to pay him, which was not a lot for Lon Chaney, and so they almost brought in John Carradine, which this movie would not probably be
Not be
as
the
good as
same,
it
no.
wouldn't be the same without Lon Chaney. There's no doubt about it. Lon Chaney is just so good in it, and he clearly is having a good time and is enjoying doing it. The fact that he's able to sort of make fun of himself and not tip it's not camp. Make fun of his werewolf thing, but really buy into it in that moment. It's
Yeah,
a
you're right. I mean, it's not camp. It's not nudge nudge. It's not the way that even Toby goes with Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, it's not got that camp element, which is maybe why it works, and I hadn't really touched on that. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
I think it's got some also great performances. Of course, Sid Haig is just doing something so wild in this movie, but he's not in as much as some of the others, including Beverly Washburn, who plays Elizabeth, and she was a child actor, and she would work again on Pit Stop. She's great in Pit Stop.
That's right, yeah.
And then Jill Banner, again, another actor in this movie who is just
So good.
seemingly out of her mind. She is just such an interesting presence. You can't stop watching her. She's so interesting. She makes her big screen debut, tragically passed away very young in a car accident. She was the girlfriend of Marlon Brando, and they were working on a script at the time. She was going to come back to acting. She left acting, was going to come back, but then passed away. But she is such an interesting performer. The two sisters work so well together in a movie where they worked together for 12 days. They had no time to work on this movie. It's very interesting. It also has probably one of the strongest dumb waiters I've ever seen in cinema. Just able to carry so many people up and down. It's really
That pulley system is genius. You know, if you can get it set right, it can pull just about anything.
And then there's a shot of when Quinn Redeker is tied up in that rocking chair that's like wildly out of focus. There's like a weird scene where he's by himself wriggling to get out of it, and it's just weirdly out of focus. I don't know if that's the Arrow Blu-ray or that's just what happened to the print.
I imagine that's just what's happened to the print, actually, to
I
be
would
honest.
imagine. Yeah.
I think watching it, though, I just thought
That
it was like somebody with poor vision was watching him struggle.
slip
And as somebody with poor vision, I was like, yeah, that's what it looks like sometimes, you know? But this is LA, so I'm not going to help him get out of those ropes. He's on his
Nope.
own.
You got to do it. That's up to
Pick
you.
up my new
That's up to
prescription.
you. But I would say that Sid Haig's performance in this is he's certainly over the top and he's very scary, but he handles it with, like you said, it's not campy. And he handles it with a certain delicacy that it makes you curious. Like what is going on with his character? Obviously, he has some struggles. But they don't call out anything. They don't try to define it in any way or prescribe like this is what he's dealing with. And he does it with such, he's over the top, but also very subtle. And so it draws you into his character versus it being it could have easily been where he's so over the top, you're like, oh, it's just that guy again. And to some degree, you kind of like his character. You kind of sympathize with him, and he's dealing with a lot, and he's trying to make the best out of it, and he doesn't know how, and he's not even in the movie that much, and yet it leaves a real impact on you when you watch it because of the way he handled it. Well, that dinner scene, that big dinner scene they have at the table where they're eating what they say is rabbit, and that scene in and of itself could have been very silly and camp. I mean, it is to a degree silly. It's played for comedy. The whole part where he can't get into the chair and everybody keeps sitting down at the table before he can't. There's obviously like very comedic beats that he's trying to hit Jack, but that scene could be even sillier and could be overdone. And Carol Omart as well was a huge get at the time outside of Lon Chaney, and her performance could also have been very camp, the way that she goes out to the forest and then comes back in to now
For a second
for
round.
having embraced the family curse, I guess, and comes in to attack them. Like that, there's parts of that could be very, they're certainly comedic, but it could be so camp. It could have stretched into that territory, and yet it doesn't. It's kind of it shows that what Jack's taste was, that he wasn't interested in doing that, but was interested in making this sort of comedic version of. Obviously, he thought, well, there's Psycho, so I'm not going to do Psycho, but I'll do the funny Psycho, which no one was doing. Nobody thought that much, and it's such a wild film.
Plus,
A great debut.
the last thing I'll say though is just doing the research as I was watching it and learning that it was incredibly hot when they were shooting and had no air conditioning, only fans. And you look at the dinner table scene, and you look at some of the scenes in the house, so you look at even the monologue that Lon Chaney gives. I just couldn't help but think you are having to overcome just to get this right. I mean, you have to know your lines, you have to have your blocking, all that stuff. And you're saying to yourself, I am on fire right now. I can't wait for this scene to be over so we can turn off the lights and I can get a cold towel on my head. So that is another reason to appreciate the acting that you're seeing on screen.
Well, for people that do live in Los Angeles, you're shooting this in August. And one of the hottest months in Los Angeles, August and September, people who live here know that. And you're in the San Fernando Valley in Glendale, one of the hottest parts of Los Angeles. So even in the 1960s, so that's warm. And I've shot a few things, and we've shot in those months, and it is the worst. It's such terrible timing to be shooting at that point in time in Los Angeles. It's so hot. Also, he was also sweating probably a little bit because he also, I mean, to be fair, was an alcoholic. And he was,
I was going to talk about
there's a
that.
variety of stories where people talk about it. Like for one, that he was filling oranges with vodka.
That's right, yeah, with vodka, yeah.
And I think Quinn had a story where he said he was maybe limiting himself to a beer every a few hours. And then Elizabeth, I read an interview where she said that he would go back to we they knew that he would have a time where he would go back to his trailer and then he would have his drink and then come back. But he was trying to still be he was still very committed and he was trying to be good, but it still required him to have some alcohol to kind of get through the day. So,
Yeah, Jack said that one of the ways that he would do it was he would actually open up an orange, so not an orange juice, but an actual orange, and he'd dip the he would like he could be on the set all day, so there was no suspicion that he was an alcoholic, because Jack said he got the impression he was quite ashamed of it, so he'd put the orange the pieces of orange into vodka and soak them in them, and then he'd sit kind of eating them. And it was only like, much later that Jack was like, "Oh, they're soaked in vodka." So that's how he's getting around it. Everybody just thinks he's eating pieces of orange. So that was the Lon Chaney story. The other thing I want to say is that Jack said that when Jill Banner passed away, Marlon Brando, this is an aside which isn't so relevant to Jack, but Marlon Brando said that she was he believed that she was the love of his life. So quite a tragic, quite a tragic young death, unfortunately. Yeah.
And a shame because her performance in this is so good and
She's
so
really good.
interesting.
She's really good. And you wonder what she would have gone on to as well,
Yeah.
especially how she was collaborating with Brando. And yes, yeah, it's really tragic.
Yeah.
And it's just sad that, like I say, this and like we have said, that this film just disappeared. I mean, it didn't really get any sort of recognition until the early 2000s, around about the time when Tarantino was kind of making waves. With well, he had just done Jackie Brown, and I think towards the end of the 90s, he was interested in, his label for the Weinsteins. I've forgotten what it was called, where he did
Rolling
Detroit.
Thunder.
Yeah, Rolling Thunder, right? After the great
The John
Bill
Flynn,
DeLorean
yeah.
film with
Yeah.
Paul Schrader, yeah, one of my favorites. I actually saw that in his New Beverly Cinema in a beat-up print. It looked fantastic, though. I actually got to see Spider Baby going off on another time. I got to see Spider Baby in 35mm because Jack's got a
Oh.
35mm print. So when we
Wow.
did the Toby Hooper
Wow.
Jack Hill weekend, yeah, we did Spider Baby in 35mm. We'd done Texas Massacre 2 in 35mm with Toby the night before. It's pretty good. But yeah, so. Yeah, it's just real shame that towards the end of the 90s, when Tarantino's doing Rolling Thunder, and he's releasing all these cool films, Blaxploitation films, Junkie Express, and he releases Switchblade Sisters. I think that's when the interest from Tarantino, at least Jack told me, was sort of, how do we get Spider Baby out there on DVD at that time? And thankfully managed to get that 35mm print, and we got the Image Entertainment DVD. And then, I think Arrow did such a great job on the Blu-ray, and that's a defining version of it until eventually we get this 4K release, which I
Yeah.
imagine will come from Jack's master, when eventually we do get a 4K release, which we should, because it's, like I said, I think it's an important film. I think over the past, 20, 25 years or so, more fans have seen it and caught on to it and kind of really dug it in a way that, a lot of Jack's films, they've not been embraced in the same way. Like Pit Stop, I still think is such an obscurity, and that's even Switchblade Sisters, Swingin' Cheerleaders, they're still quite obscure. But I get, from my experience of, speaking to horror fans and stuff, I think Spider Babies had somewhat of a bigger appreciation. And I still don't think it's got the audience it deserves yet.
I totally agree
Agreed.
with those, and partly why we're doing this whole series. But can I ask, like, what is your personal favorite Jack Hill film? Is it this, or is it something else?
No, I mean, I think Coffee is my favorite. I think that's sort of like his masterpiece,
It's
and
really good.
it's, yeah, I mean, it's a film which, is as a blaxploitation film, it's, in its own right, it's at or near the top, if Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song is kind of like, the kind of template for blaxploitation, but sort of sets out an impossible kind of style for other films to follow. I think Coffee, as a more studio-like piece of cinema is just such good fun and so dominated by Pam and so exciting and has such a good pace and has so many fun lines and has that great ending and the sort of fantastic soundtrack, especially at the end as she walks down the beach with a shotgun. I think it's such a good film. So I think I would go with Coffee as my favorite Jack Hill film.
Solid, solid choice. I was luckily able to see that on film for the very first time in a theater in San
Oh,
Francisco.
that's so cool.
That was like my first, I got to, I saw both of Jack's films with Pam on film. Very terrible looking print, but an absolutely great experience to see it because it is like a terrific movie. I'm such a huge fan of that. And that's, was around that time of Switchblade Sisters. And I was like, who is this guy that, this Jack Hill, my God. Such good, great films. And another thing we have to talk to you about while you're here, you can see slightly over Mark's shoulder there, but that's the poster for Sorceress,
Oh, cool!
which is
Kirsten Hayes, talk about a demeaning role, eh? It's got to be a sorceress role.
I mean, I know it's a movie he took his name off of, and as you said, a time he goes back again to Corman. He sort of returns to Corman several times. And this one being the final straw. But it's again one of those movies that if you it's just an interesting movie, a movie called Sorceress with no sorceresses in them whatsoever. And it's just such a fascinating movie, but it's interesting. It's a sad footnote in his career because it's his final directed film and he took his name off of and was very upset with it.
I mean, I'll just say a few things just to kind of, expand on what you said about Sid Haig. Like, Jack tried to get money to get Sid Haig in it and, was really bummed that Sid, Roger Corman wouldn't cough up the extra money to bring Sid to Mexico and film this part in Sorceress. But if you look at the role that he was pegged for, it's just so fucking demeaning, pardon my language, that it's just kind of like, I'm so glad that Sid, poor Sid Haig, you lost a paycheck, but at least he's not in Sorceress. I think, yeah, it's a bad film. It's a bad film. It's a
It's
bad
it,
film. I think
right.
that I know that afterwards Jack sort of went away and, practiced yoga and became sort of like a bit of a hippie and, God bless him for doing that and everything. But I think that after the Tarantino thing and, Quentin sort of, getting him to sign his vinyls for Coffee and Foxy Brown and, doing Switchblade Sisters and releasing that on DVD. And of course, you've got to remember after I know Jackie Brown wasn't as successful as Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs, but Tarantino's still like, the most recognizable probably filmmaker on the planet other than maybe Spielberg at the time. And to some extent probably still is, right? And I think that Jack expected or anticipated that that would rub off and people would go, oh, cool, Jack Hill, let's make a movie with you. And it never happened. And I think that a lot of the older directors who got embraced by a new wave of filmmakers who are very genre literate and who really like their films kind of became maybe a little bit bitter again that that didn't really kind of result in a second coming for them, I remember when they were doing 2001 Maniacs. I remember the director of that telling me that Herschel Gordon Lewis was kind of like, you should let me direct the gore scenes. I'll come back and have a comeback and direct the gore scenes. And the guy was like, well, no, I mean I'm making this movie. It's my first movie. I want to, it's got to be my movie sort of thing. And I know somebody else who I won't mention because I think his film's garbage, but Eli Roth told me that he had said, oh, I like your movie or whatever, and I just met him at a midnight screening of it or a retro screening, and the guy like hassled Eli like for weeks afterward, like emailing him and stuff and saying, hey, do you think we can get together and collaborate and maybe do a remake of my film? And Eli said to me, he said, "What, I really like to say to him, look, I like your film, but I like it in a kind of ironic way. I'm not about to, get millions of dollars to make a remake of it with you,
Right.
So I think there was maybe an expectancy that Eli Roth, Quentin Tarantino, Rob Zombie, that these guys who are having a successful filmmaking career might rub off on some of these older filmmakers who had, been sitting out for a few decades, and not had that success. And in the case of really all of them, it didn't really result in any sort of being able to make a new movie. So I always, I felt sorry for Jack in that regard. I felt, kind of, well, Pam's had a second life now, when am I going to get to make my next movie? But I mean, the only thing I'll say is that Jack sent me a script he'd written, and it was a love story. And no, I love the guy and everything, but nobody I think was ever going to fund a Jack Hill love story. I think even if you were going to go low budget and have a, go and make more movies the way that, Ted V. McKells did, you are going to be making the Corpse Grinders too. You're not going to be making Ted V. McKells Presents a Romance. There's not a market for that, and when Herschel Gordon Lewis made his comeback, right? And he did Blood Feast too, which is fun, it's a Herschel Gordon Lewis movie, that's it. He knows what his audience is, he knows what he's got to do, he realizes that he's not going to be shooting on 35 millimeter anymore. It's digital film. And it's kind of cheesy special effects, but there's going to be gore, and there's going to be a John Waters cameo, and it's going to be Blood Feast 2, like whatever, that's it. And I always, I sort of felt that I was in my 20s at the time. I don't know the industry so much or anything, but even then I was kind of like, Jack Hill's going to make another film. It kind of needs to be a Jack Hill film, I think. And even then, it's probably not going to be the film he wants to make, because the days of being able to have a Roger Corman or a Sam Arkoff who's going to give you whatever the 2005 2004 equivalent of $1.5 million was, to go out and film on 35 millimeter with even up and coming stars, be it Sid Haig or in the case of Coffee and Foxy Brown, a Pam Grier, that era of film is gone, baby.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah. Any final thoughts on Spider Baby before we wrap up?
No.
It's
Callum.
hard. It's hard to beat that
Yeah.
last statement.
No, I
That
mean, that
that's the
feels like
perfect
that's the end there.
crescendo.
Well done.
Callum, thank you so
It's
much
sad,
for.
right? But yeah, you can't have these grindhouse days back. They're gone. They're in the past.
I mean,
For
that's the
sure.
thing. There's so many. Even Corman had to constantly pivot. He was so in the drive-in, and then Star Wars and Jaws hit, and that was a very difficult time for him because the
Held his
studios
own
were
for a
making his
while,
kind of
though.
movies.
He held his own for a while as well. That's the thing. I mean, he was, Corman was kind of, doing Piranha and like some really cool films as well in that period. But like you say, I mean, when I saw Roger in 2010 at the Sitges Film Festival, and he was, there were going to be, he was going to be premiering his latest made for sci-fi film, and it's not the Roger Corman films of the past, the times are gone. It's not even Trip to Kill or something, it's
It's the Dino Crocs, not even the
it's a
stuff he
Dino
did.
Crutch,
Not even like the movies he made for Showtime or some of the eras. Like he had an amazing way of pivoting, and not everybody was able to do that. But it's when you're making a certain type of movie, it's hard. It's the times have changed. It's very difficult. So,
That's it.
Callum, thank you so much for joining
Thank you
us
for
for
having me,
this
guys.
yes,
Very
thank you
first
so
episode.
much.
Is there any way you want people to kind of seek you out anywhere, or where people can find you
No, please
besides?
never seek me out. I'm enjoying my relative obscurity.
Well, definitely pick up your book. I would just say to anybody that is interested in Jack Hill, we will be referencing it throughout this series big time because it
Cheers, thank
is,
you.
and it's called Jack Hill, The Exploitation of Blaxploitation Master, Film by Film. Please seek it out and please read it. It's an important work for particularly this series, but for anybody that enjoys film. So, Callum, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you guys.
Thank
Take
you.
care.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network, please select the link in the description.
Are you a film fan who loves the ultimate home video experience? Look no further than The Disconnected. Your host, Ryan Verrill, is your go-to source for the latest and most accurate information on home video releases, exclusive interviews with industry insiders and filmmakers, and has established a thriving community where every film and physical media enthusiast feels welcome. From hidden gems to blockbuster hits, The Disconnected brings you insider knowledge and a welcoming space to share your love of cinema. Watch every Thursday night at 9:30 Eastern, 6:30 Pacific for the live announcements show and follow The Disconnected on social media to stay updated. Subscribe to The Disconnected on YouTube or on the podcast provider of your choice and dive into a world where every movie night is an adventure.